And we're back. It is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. What you heard there was that magnificent voice of James Baldwin, who wrote an essay. If you haven't read it, you can buy it. It turned it into a little book, and it was called The Fire Next Time. And you know how it goes. The line in the Bible is, God gave Noah the rainbow sign. No more water, the fire next time. And that was before all of America got lit up in the mid-1960s. If you haven't heard that happened, you probably ought to go look. I realize sometimes I say these things and as though everybody knows it. Not everybody knows it. There was not an American city that was did not experience a lot of fire. And by the way, it's a wonder James Baldwin, I don't know if he was alive, that they didn't arrest him, but he was just simply pointing out the obvious. You know, America hit a wall. They murdered every last black leader they could get their hands on. And nobody ever got prosecuted or found or, you know. So you better go see this film, I'm Not Your Negro. This is Black History Month, coming to the end of it.
I wanted to say that Baldwin quotes at the beginning of that trailer that we heard, that where he's quoting that what every American kid learns in school, Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death. And I just want to remind people, Patrick Henry was a slave owner.
Yeah.
So liberty didn't apply to the slaves. It was just applied
to him.
It
didn't apply.
Yeah.
No. And as he pointed out, that goes unsaid. Yeah. The chasm between a white person saying it and a black is just, you know, immense. So this is the Taylor Report. It is CIUT 89.5 FM. And we are joined now, I believe, by Mr. Stephen Gowans. Are you there, Stephen?
Yes. Hello, Phil.
Thank you very much for talking to us. I know you got a book coming out soon. It's going to be titled Washington's Long War on Syria. And I think this book is definitely needed widely. There are not that many books that are being published that are critical or revealing about U.S. policy towards the Middle East and Syria in particular. And just by the way, to start off, a very courageous Canadian journalist, Eva Bartlett, has been to Syria recently and come back with reports that contradict those that we find in the New York Times and the London Telegraph and the Toronto Star. And she's been given a bit of a hard time. I know that you were at a public meeting where she spoke and you introduced her, I believe. What was on your mind? What did you tell the audience about Eva Bartlett?
About Eva?
That evening.
Well, I did tell them something about Eva. I said that she was an extraordinary person, which she is. And I did spend some time with her after the talk as well, which was a very enjoyable and enlightening conversation. And it only, convinced me all the more strongly that she is an extraordinary person. Mm-hmm. But what I did in introducing her is I provided some background on Syria, because I think that much of the discussion about Syria is completely ahistorical and makes little reference to any of the events that have surrounded the development of what I think of as a renewed Islamist insurgency in Syria, and a renewed Islamist insurgency which has been helped along by the United States. So I simply talked about the major forces in post-war Syrian history, which are, political Islam on the one hand, and secular Arab nationalism on the other, and both of these forces competing for control of the state, and an external force, which is U.S. imperialism, also trying to impose its will on the Syrian people and control the state, and allying with political Islam to oust the secular Arab nationalists, which neither political Islam or U.S. imperialists are particularly fond of.
Mm-hmm. your thesis is, and I agree, by the way, that there is an ahistorical way of treating this, or it may be a new historical, in the sense that we have a phenomenon they like to call, and they gave it the name, Arab Spring. So it's as though the problems of Syria vis-a-vis the United States and the Gulf monarchies, Muslim Brotherhood, we have not mentioned it, happened because there was a spring, that there was something spontaneous going on. I don't think you believe it was spontaneous, what happened in 2011.
No, I mean, not at all. I mean, I became interested in what was happening in Syria before 2011. Because these things don't just spring out of a vacuum. And, you know, one of the books I read was by the late Middle East specialist Patrick Seale, who knew something about Syria. He followed Syrian politics for decades. And he wrote about the Syrian uprising that it should only be seen as the latest, if by far the most violent episode in a long war between Islamists and the secular Arab nationalists. And this war had dated back to the founding of the Ba'ath Party, which is the main Arab nationalist party in the 1940s. And he noted that the struggle between them is by now little short of a death feud. So it's not as if suddenly in 2011 there was a democratic uprising in Syria, as some people would like us to believe. This is simply a continuation of a long-standing death feud. But it was a long-standing death feud in which the United States had interposed itself in the middle of. And it wasn't the first time the United States had done that. In 1982, the Muslim Brothers, which is the main political Islamist group in Syria, had seized control of Syria's fourth largest city, Hama. And they went on a rampage through the city. They killed anyone they could find who was associated with the government. They killed soldiers. They beheaded people. They murdered every Ba'ath Party official and relative they could find. And in the operation to quell the uprising, the Syrian Arab Army captured more than 15,000 foreign-supplied machine guns, along with prisoners, including Jordanian and CIA-trained paramilitary forces. So the U.S. involvement in Syria in an attempt to change the Syrian government, and doing so in alliance with violent political Islam, is something that's been going on for quite some time. Mm-hmm. And the reasons for it haven't changed. The United States doesn't like secular Arab nationalism, and it doesn't like secular Arab nationalism because the nationalists insist on zealously asserting the sovereign right of the country to make its own decisions, because they always reject U.S. economic policy prescriptions on the grounds that these are prescriptions that benefit U.S. corporations and investors and banks at the expense of Syrians. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. has always opposed the secular Arab nationalists because the nationalists have insisted on basing their economic development on a heavy role for government in the guidance of the economy, which reduces opportunities for investment and exports for U.S. firms and corporations and investors. Mm-hmm. So for this reason, I mean, the United States used to talk about the current president's father, Hafez al-Assad, as an Arab communist. Yeah. Who was yeah. presiding over, they still say, in fact, that his son, Bashar, is presiding over an economy based on Soviet models. And we all know, of course, that the United States doesn't think very highly of economies that are based on Soviet models. And that's one of the principal reasons why they have been trying to overthrow the Syrian government for decades.
This is Stephen Gowans, but Stephen has a book coming out soon, and we're all anxious to see it, Washington's Long War on Syria. And Stephen, when they talk about Assad, isn't there a kind of a game going on by invoking the name? They say, well, he has to step down. But don't they indeed actually mean, as you point out, the Ba'athist party has to be removed? And you're talking about a major body-destroying surgery. I mean, this, but they don't say that. They said, oh, he has to step down. That would be impossible without the removal of his party, right?
Right, and I think the model is Iraq. So Iraq is also governed by secular Arab nationalists under Saddam Hussein. So they said Saddam Hussein has to go. Well, what was the first thing that happened after Saddam Hussein was gone? The first act was passed by Paul Bremer, you know, the pro-council that the United States installed to reorient the Iraqi economy, was the de-Ba'athification both of Iraqi politics and of the economy, essentially.
Yes. I remember he also gave him a blue and white flag, and people thought, where did that come from?
But essentially,
the flag didn't fly very long, actually.
The operation was what they called de-Ba'athification, or elimination of secular Arab nationalism from the Iraqi state. Mm-hmm. And they constructed a constitution that essentially bans secular Arab nationalism from Iraq forever. Mm-hmm. They even have measures to ensure that secular Arab nationalists don't run for election or can't participate in elections. And, you know, since 2011, I believe that the U.S. campaign or program in Syria is essentially to do in Syria what they did in Iraq, which is to de-Ba'athify the state.
Yes. By the way, they always come in the name of reform, or they're going to put together a what they call appropriate democracy. But it always involves the negation, entire negation of anybody who served previous. So it really is, better language would be a coup, right? As, I mean, we know this has happened in Ukraine, for example. The first thing they did was declare that the party of the outgoing, the man who'd been removed or chased out of the country, his party wasn't allowed to compete.
Mm-hmm. No, exactly.
We're speaking to Stephen Gowans, and get ready for the book, by the way. You can order it, Baraka Books. It's Washington's Long War on Syria. Stephen, you must be watching with some interest the curious hysteria now emerging around the new president. I wonder, I haven't noticed. It's been 100 days. I really don't see any dramatic change in policy. I see a lot of arguing and wrestling under tables by people that should be standing and talking. What is going on with the Obama group that went out? They are talking as though this man Trump is sold out everything, and they talk about him as a traitor. People like Michael Moore and others. This, when you look at, I hate to try to tie this to Syria, but is there any significant change? And do you think the long term interest and outlook is going to be altered?
Well, I think that, the United States is dominated by a certain billionaire class, whether it's Democrats or Republicans. But there are divisions within that billionaire class and different ideas about how policy should be formulated. But are they wildly different? I don't think so. But I think there's a struggle within kind of the U.S. governing or political class over, which part of that billionaire class should be dominating the country. And you're right, it's hysterical and it's absurd, this kind of campaign that goes on. That's, it's just risible. It's laughable. If you look at Paul Krugman in the New York Times, I don't even read him anymore, because as soon as he started talking about the Trump-Putin regime, he'd lost his mind.
The New York Times on the weekend had what they call a think piece, where they allow a columnist to do three columns at once. I forget who it was, wrote the piece, but she said, Trump is Putin. That was the conclusion. They are just kind of the same guy, basically. And, it is quite mad.
And then the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal continue to talk about how it is that Trump has praised Putin repeatedly And yet you can only really find two statements that Trump has ever made about Putin that could be construed as praise. He said, A, he is well-regarded in his country or has support, and B, he seems to be intelligent, both of which are factual comments.
Manifestly true.
Yeah, and even if you want to regard them as being adulatory, there's still simply two comments. It's not as if there's this ongoing pattern of praising and building up Putin. Mm-hmm. And it's got to the point where I've heard people that I know tell me that they believe that, or they've now grown to believe that Putin and Trump have this long-standing relationship. They've never met each other face-to-face.
Yes. Now, that raises something we've been treating on this program a little bit, is that a few years back, we would talk about Turkey and what that, you know, is going on with, say, Mr. Erdogan and the army. And we would similarly, we would talk about Egypt and the army, and then we would talk about the presidents who got elected and disappeared and then the other things. And then always when these discussions went on, we would say deep state. And matter of fact, when I say we, I mean all media would say there's a deep state issue. For the first time, I'm hearing about America having a deep state, which I assume just refers to a ruling group that sorts things out in, as they might. But what do you think of this new phenomenon where we're talking about America with a deep state?
Yes. Well, you know, I've always believed that the United States has a deep state, depending on how you define deep state. If you wanted to define it as a state that's deeply penetrated by, to use the phrase I was using, a billionaire class, then, I mean, that's always been the case. The billionaire class has penetrated the U.S. state. Or, I mean, in the U.K., for example, you also have a deep state where, this, you know, the governments come and go, but the state persists. Mm-hmm. And the state is filled in its highest reaches in the UK. It's been traditionally by people who are associated with landed wealth. Even today, if you look at the UK, you look at most of the people in the state in the top bureaucratic positions have all been to these upper class public schools.
Yes. Well, that's a very good point. I mean, your books, your previous writing, and I really urge people to always go to Steve Gowan's writing. He's at gowans.wordpress.com. And you've spoken about, written about this, that, you know, they go to the same schools, but they also have a lot of institutes. Maybe you could, what is it, the National Security? There's one grouping where you really have to be the right pedigree to go to be attending the meetings.
The U.S., the Council on Foreign Relations?
Yes, the Council of Foreign Relations.
Yes.
Hard to be a member of that. By the way, these guys, as far as I know, in the cabinet with of Mr. Trump, pretty much members, are they not, for the most part, except as people keep talking about Mr. Bannon. But Bannon's a former Army officer, and he went to a pretty good school.
Or naval, yeah.
And but, Navy, yes, pardon me.
Yeah. But I mean, if you think about the deep state, you can also think about it in terms of the deep state being the security services, the intelligence services, and the influence they have. And there's a very good book written by some Canadian academics about Canadian intelligence service called, I think it's called Secret Service. But it also talks about how it is that intelligence services in the U.K., have been responsible for one British prime minister stepping down, about how it is that the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, had for many years bugged U.S. presidents and knew they were being bugged and could do nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And it also reminds me of the Democratic senator who said that Trump ought not to criticize the intelligence services because, quote, they have six ways of to Sunday to get him.
Charming. do you see an example of this might be we hear about movements of personnel that maybe there's going to be a commitment of troops. And, you know, when you hear that, you assume that, you know, a lot of the policies, what you might call in the pipe, in other words, they were already doing it, and as your book illustrates, this is a long-term thing. So they really don't think they have to phone the boss and say, what do you think? Should we continue to weaken a government that doesn't like capitalists, or what do you think? I think they know the answer, right? But if they begin to do things like initiate things in eastern Syria, if I've got the right side of this country, in a way, the president is – he – whether he likes it or not, he's part of the team. He kind of has to go along, right?
Yeah, and then that's one of the great misconceptions that people have about the presidency, as if it's some kind of autocracy, and once you become president, you can call all the shots. I think it was there's an historian who specializes in Korea who was asked about, well, what would happen if Trump becomes president? And he said, well, Trump will be like Eisenhower. Eisenhower was a general, was accustomed to giving orders and having them followed. He became president, discovered that he gave orders, checked 2 months later, and found out that no one was actually following them. And Trump's going to discover the same thing. But I mean, that's the case. I mean, Obama certainly discovered that. And all presidents discovered that.
We're going to close Guantanamo in the first 100 days. And when he left, he said, I still think it's a good idea. The most powerful man on earth.
Absolutely. And then there's the case of the agreement that had been struck between, I gather, Obama or Kerry and the Russians to coordinate their airstrikes against terrorist forces in Syria, which was undermined by the Pentagon, which wasn't willing to go along.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Stephen Gowans in the latter part of the program. Stephen, I've been wanting to ask you this about the policy of regime change, which is really quite zealous, and we're having a fight to the death in Syria. If we were to look at the nomenclature, say 5 years ago, maybe 10, everybody that America liked was always called pro-democracy. If there was something going on in Poland, it was pro-democracy. If there's something going on in Ukraine, it was pro-democracy. And I haven't heard anybody use the word pro-democracy in connection with the moderates in Syria. Have you?
No. Early on, they did.
What are they moderate about?
Well, yes, I know. A propaganda term intended to deceive. I mean, no one's moderate with respect to what?
Mm-hmm. But isn't it interesting? I mean, it seems to me that just as people who watch language, they've dropped the term. I don't see it around much. Wherever I look, they're no longer using it. They seem to be using new terminology, hovering around the word moderate or, I don't know, stable, things like that. But it's very interesting that they would be waging this thing both in Iraq and in Syria. And in the case, I don't even know if they use the word pro-democracy in Libya now that I think of it. I doubt it. They seem to know that they were associated with Islamic zealots and that they couldn't dare use the word.
Yeah, because you can't really find any of the insurgents who actually have the goal of establishing a democratic state. They have the goal of establishing Islamic states.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be pretty difficult for the United States to talk about democracy promotion in the Middle East when their principal allies are anti-democratic, you know, despots, monarchs, et cetera. I mean, Saudi Arabia is hardly a democracy. Nor is Egypt.
Yes, and when Bahrain said that they wouldn't mind having a democracy, the Saudis sent an army, right?
Yes. It's an army to crush those who are calling for, essentially a constitutional monarchy.
Wow. Well, Stephen Gowans, it's always great to talk to you. Washington's Long War on Syria, the book is coming out. As a matter of fact, your publisher announced on their website that it's going to be out in Chinese. So
Yes, it is.
Congratulations. Well, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Okey-doke.
Bye.
Bye. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, and I want to thank Ian and Phil Conlon. Thank you very, very much. I guess that's it. We'll see you next week.